50 rolls of 35mm film that contained high-quality images taken with the Pentax. After nearly a year of experience with Tolkachev, the CIA determined that he could be trusted with more advanced and sensitive gear. OTS then provided two of its best custom 4mm lens sub-miniature cameras in October of 1979 and four more in December. The cameras, which produced 50 frames, were packaged in active concealments and could be disguised as almost any commonly carried item, such as a pen, a cigarette lighter, or a tube of lipstick. More problems arose in December of 1979 when Tolkachev's institute introduced new security procedures. Under the new guidelines, he could no longer check out an unlimited number of classified documents from the institute library, promising they would be returned by the end of the workday, then run home for an impromptu photo session. With the new procedures, classified documents could still be checked out, but only if the borrower's building pass, propusk, was left in the library. This ended his ability to photograph documents at home. Improvising, Tolkachev began photographing documents inside a bathroom stall during working hours. By February, he had filled four of his six sub-miniature cameras with over 200 exposures, but remained dissatisfied with the small camera, complaining that it still required too much light, was difficult to hold steady, and sometimes malfunctioned. In order to return to his home photography, Tolkachev suggested the CIA fabricate an exact reproduction of his propusk, building pass, to leave in the library while he used his genuine pass to enter and exit the building. To this end, he provided a color photograph and description of the pass to create the replica. However, before the fake pass could be fabricated, the new security restrictions were abruptly canceled because record-keeping under the guidelines became a burden for the library staff. The impact of the change was immediate, as Tolkachev was again able to take documents home to photograph with his Pentax. Weather proved to be an unexpected, although important, factor. During the winter, his heavy outer clothing allowed him to conceal more documents than during the summer. In June of 1980, more than 200 rolls of 35mm film were passed, the largest exchange of film in one meeting. Despite the surprise change of security requirements at the Institute, graphic artists at OTS continued work on the propusk reproduction. In October of 1980, Tolkachev then asked the CIA to reproduce the Institute's document sign-out card containing a running list of all documents he accessed. He was justifiably worried, since a leak could trigger an investigation leading to the Institute and document cards. However, a clean sign-out card would sever all links between him and the compromised documents. In the fall of 1980, Tolkachev was issued an emergency backup communication system based on the Schrack technology originally developed for Polyakov. This second-generation buster could transmit an entire typewritten page of text and partially eliminate the need for riskier personal meetings. The new Schrack, called Discus, consisted of two identical units for case officer and agent, the size of two cigarette packs laid end-to-end. Each unit had a small detachable antenna, charger, battery pack, Russian or English key plates, and instructions. In advance of an exchange, the agent and case officer would key in their respective messages one character at a time. As each character was entered, the unit automatically converted it to a cipher before storing it. These new units exchanged messages in burst transmissions of less than 3 seconds. The Discus system also had a longer line-of-sight transmission range than Buster, and once received, a message was automatically deciphered and readable on a small screen built into the face of each unit. Tolkachev received a Discus in March of 1981, but a malfunction necessitated a replacement unit, and some months later, a successful exchange of messages occurred. Using this new technology required all the elements of disciplined tradecraft perfected for Moscow operations. For Tolkachev, the communications plan involved initiating the exchange by leaving a signal, such as a white chalk mark on a specific telephone pole along the route normally taken by CIA officers. Once the signal was laid down and acknowledged, the agent and case officer would move into that prearranged ELD, electronic dead drop, area at the same time for the exchange. OTS completed the fake sign-out card and passed it along with the duplicate propusk to Tolkachev in March of 1981. Wasting no time, he quickly swapped the new clean document sign-out card for the original, confident he was safe, at least for the immediate time being. The outside cover for the forged propusk, however, was a slightly different color than the original and returned. Fortunately, with the relaxed security procedures, he was still able to check out documents without having to surrender his building pass. To ensure continued contact in case of emergency, Tolkachev was given a commercially available shortwave radio, an OTS demodulator, and two OTPs. Part of an interim one-way link, IOWL, the system was a technical upgrade version of what Penkovsky used 20 years earlier. However, because of limited privacy at his apartment and problems related to transmission times, the system had only limited operational utility for Tolkachev. In November of 1981, the Institute reinstated the security restriction that required building passes be surrendered when checking documents out. Fortunately, OTS had a new fake pass waiting, but again Tolkachev judged the color match to be less than perfect. Recognizing the technical difficulty facing the OTS artists attempting to duplicate the precise color of a folder they had only seen in a photograph, he proposed loaning the CIA the original pass for 2 months during his vacation in January and February of 1982. However, the handler worried that the risk was too great if the return of the original was delayed. Tolkachev's safety was of paramount importance, even if it meant decreased production. Then, in March of 1982, Tolkachev contacted the CIA for an unscheduled meeting and passed his handler a piece of the external cover of an original propusk, enabling OTS to match precisely the colors. With the increased security and no longer able to copy documents at home during his lunch hour, Tolkachev's production decreased significantly. However, even the reduced level of production was significant, given the constraints on copying. Once, his case officer commented that photographing the documents at work was dangerous. Tolkachev laughed and replied, "Everything is dangerous." Tolkachev preferred the face-to-face method of passing material to his case officers and receiving new gear. 10 such clandestine encounters occurred between October of 1980 and November of 1983. Each meeting first depended on the CIA officer's confidence that he had been able to evade KGB surveillance. If there was any doubt, the meeting was aborted. Pervasive surveillance of suspected officers required creative as well as technical solutions by OTS to defeat the Soviets. The SRR-100 receiver that monitored surveillance team's transmission had been upgraded since its discovery by the KGB when Martha Peterson was arrested. Although it remained a valuable tool, the Soviets had also changed procedures, making reliance on just the SRR-100 alone unwise. Case officers meeting Tolkachev needed other means to free themselves from surveillance. One possible solution arose from the increased use of private automobiles in Moscow. In studying KGB surveillance tactics, case officers concluded there were moments when a passenger could exit the car unobserved by surveillance. If the passenger's profile could be replaced, the surveillance team would continue to believe they had their target in sight, while the officer was free to operate black. Getting out of the car was a tradecraft problem left to case officers, but creating a device to replicate their profile became an OTS technical challenge. What followed evolved into one of OTS's stranger attempts to adapt consumer technology for clandestine use. 2 young OTS engineers were dispatched to a windowless store in Washington, D.C.'s seedy red light district on 14th Street. Inside, they examined the stock of adult entertainment and sex enhancement products until they found what they needed: 3 inflatable human figures intended for use as sex dolls. Although the figurines were excessively detailed in anatomical respects, they also possessed all the necessary features to become an inflatable piece of tradecraft. Technical requirements stipulated that the dolls needed to inflate quickly and sit up straight. The dummy occupant of the car had to appear in the passenger seat within a split second after the passenger exited, since a car could be obscured from the KGB surveillance for only brief moments, such as rounding a corner. This required, the techs reasoned, a burst of compressed air to inflate the mannequin, which would pop out of some kind of container. Initial testing demonstrated that the figurine's construction could not withstand the pressure of a rapid inflation in less than a second. Seams blew out, and slow air leakage was common, affecting the doll's posture. Discreet acquisition of additional test dolls became problematic, if not embarrassing. When the young techs returned to a store for more dolls, the proprietor's quizzical stare seemed to raise uncomfortable questions about their private lives. After all, they could not explain, "You see, we work for the CIA, and..." Even with reinforced seams, stronger materials, and less air pressure for rapid inflation, the problems persisted. The inflatable mannequins continued to sag in the wrong places, resulting in a less-than-lifelike appearance. The sagging was corrected by installing a valve to provide continuous slow inflation, but the valve had a tendency to hiss. Quality control by manufacturers was another problem. All mannequins did not equally tolerate rapid inflation. Once the figure was inflated and in place, the techs had to devise an equally rapid deflation and efficient storage process for the device that would allow the case officer to re-enter the car and take his place in the passenger seat as quickly as he had exited. It was then that the research veered to the elegant solution. Was it necessary to create the most lifelike mannequin possible? KGB surveillance teams typically followed from behind or in front. Rarely did they pull alongside a car. Perhaps a three-dimensional representation was not required. Maybe all that was needed was a two-dimensional figure of the torso with a three-dimensional head. An alternative wooden, metal, and plastic mechanical pop-up prototype was constructed, eliminating inflatable dolls, air pumps, and difficult-to-explain trips to 14th Street. This new piece of tradecraft acquired the nickname Jack-in-the-Box, or Jib. The final product could be concealed in a medium-sized briefcase placed on the passenger seat. No installation was required. With one hand, a driver unlatched the briefcase, and the Jib popped instantly into place. When the passenger was set to re-enter the car, the Jib could be pushed back into its resting position with one hand, and the briefcase shoved to the floor. In May 1982, personal meetings with Tolkachev were temporarily suspended when increased KGB surveillance forced CIA officers to abort several planned meetings. Eventually, using the Jib, an officer was able to re-establish direct contact. Tolkachev had remained active, using his fake building pass to evade security restrictions, and his home photo sessions continued. Unexpectedly, another set of restrictions had been imposed at the Institute involving a new style of propusk, so the fake building pass that had just begun to work was now worthless. Compounding the problem were other regulations that limited all but a few senior officers from leaving the Institute without written permission, except during lunch. Increasingly, Tolkachev's only opportunity to photograph documents would be inside the Institute. CIA assessed the new security regulations as an indication that the KGB suspected the loss of information from the Institute, and attempts were underway to limit those losses until the leak could be identified. Tolkachev was urged to stand down, but the persistent agent would not stop his spying. Tolkachev next provided a photograph of the new building pass and a color strip from the cover to assist OTS in creating a duplicate. He reported smuggling his 35mm camera into the Institute on three occasions to photograph documents at his desk, and turned over a dozen rolls of film in March 1983 and another dozen in April. As a result, upgraded miniature document cameras were given to Tolkachev for use inside the Institute, along with directions to stop taking documents home. New apprehension about Tolkachev's security arose in April, after he passed information about a new Soviet fighter aircraft target recognition system. The Institute's security department requested a list of all personnel with access to that specific information. Tolkachev, convinced that the leak could be traced back to him, destroyed all his spy gear and other potentially incriminating possessions. His Schrack device, Pentax camera, charred remains of documents were all tossed out of his car along a stretch of road during the drive back from his country dacha. Throughout the autumn of 1983, 5 attempted personal meetings were canceled because of KGB surveillance or Tolkachev's scheduling problems. When a meeting did finally occur in mid-November, he had no film, but provided 16 pages of handwritten notes. The case officer passed him 2 newly designed document cameras, a light meter, and a proposed schedule for future meetings. Tolkachev's family situation required a change of communications plans. Since the inception of the operation, unattributable calls from payphones located throughout Moscow to his home had been used by case officers to initiate unplanned meetings. This worked well until Tolkachev's son, in whose room the phone was located, became a teenager. Like most teens, at the first ring of the phone, the young man ran to it. The Kamo plan that successfully evaded KGB surveillance for 4 years now became vulnerable to a teenager who thought that every incoming call could be for him. From the earliest stages of the case, the CIA began planning for a means of exfiltrating Tolkachev and his family out of Moscow. Ideally, Tolkachev could remain in place as long as possible, but there was always the potential of an emergency requiring immediate exfiltration. Tolkachev realized the consequences if he were ever caught. 4 months after his initial meeting, he asked his case officer for a poison pill, stating, "I would not like to carry on a conversation with organs of the KGB." His request was refused by headquarters, but he persisted and eventually wrote a personal letter to the DCI pleading his case. Tolkachev reasoned that the tasking required him to request highly sensitive documents that were outside his normal work. If he was willing to take this risk, then the agency should be willing to provide him a poison pill. Additionally, he suggested that this means of defense would limit any disclosures he might unwillingly make during an interrogation. Tolkachev assumed that if he were to be arrested, the scenario would begin with a summons to the office of his boss, where he would be seized. Now, as security continued to tighten at the Institute, any time he was called to the office, he would conceal the poison pill beneath his tongue so he could immediately bite it. Given these urgent circumstances, Tolkachev stopped all document photography, but continued to make notes on topics of known intelligence value. His Moscow officer was prescient when writing to headquarters. "This is indeed a man who is driven to produce, by whatever means he deems necessary, right up to the end, even if that end is his death." When the Institute's new security regulations in early 1983 indicated to Tolkachev that Soviet authorities were suspicious that sensitive information was leaking, exfiltration planning was moved to the front burner. His case officer evaluated escape plans and concluded the Leningrad option would be best. This involved getting his family to Leningrad, then smuggling them out of the USSR in an OTS-constructed concealment cavity built into a vehicle. If the family was unable to reach Leningrad, a backup plan called for them to be picked up on the outskirts of Moscow, where they would remain in hiding until exfiltration from the country by another means. Tolkachev was offered details of the completed plan in April, but refused to accept them because of his current family situation. Both his wife and son knew people who left the USSR for Israel and later wrote back that they regretted the move. The CIA escape plans were no match for his wife's emotional bond to the Russian homeland or his son's attachment to his friends. Tolkachev later commented that he could not think about exfiltration because I could never leave my family. Headquarters determined the aviation information Tolkachev reported in March of 1983 had not been disseminated outside of CIA until June, leading to the assumption that no leak could have alerted the KGB in April. Nevertheless, the agency decided to restrict future meetings with Tolkachev to twice a year and provided a new Schrack device to replace the one he destroyed. He was directed to use extreme caution, limit collection activities to writing notes, and to take photographs only if he felt completely secure using the sub-miniature cameras. In April of 1984, Tolkachev passed 2 full cameras and 39 pages of handwritten notes, 26 of which contained detailed intelligence. The images in the spy cameras were of excellent quality. In turn, he received 2 new cameras, a communications plan, and 100,000 rubles, but again refused an exfiltration plan. His spirits seemed high. No problems were reported from the security scare of the previous year. He apologized for destroying his Pentax 35mm camera and requested a replacement. The case officer concluded that, from Tolkachev's perspective, the operation was back to normal. The CIA's assessment of Tolkachev's situation was decidedly less rosy. He was not given a replacement Pentax camera because his handlers did not want him to risk removing documents from the Institute. At an October meeting where he passed 22 pages of handwritten notes, he also pressed his request for a Pentax and insisted he was ready to return to work. The Moscow office expressed concern that if Tolkachev was not given another 35mm camera, he would obtain one locally. As an alternative, Tolkachev was given additional document copy cameras in an attempt to satisfy his compulsion to photograph documents. In January 1985, Tolkachev returned 3 expended sub-miniature cameras and 16 pages of handwritten notes. His resupply included 5 fresh cameras, new intelligence requirements, and another 100,000 rubles. He explained he had been able to take better photographs inside the Institute because the work was done from a toilet stall near a window. This gave him more light, and he could arrange for another stop inside the building as cover for the 20 to 25 minutes he was away from his desk. Unfortunately, the images, taken on an overcast day, were underexposed and unreadable. Tolkachev's behavior in the January meeting seemed normal. His written information was consistent in terms of subject matter, quantity, and quality of his previous offerings, and the case officer detected no change in surveillance activities before or after the meeting. Nothing indicated that Tolkachev was compromised or working under KGB control. According to his notes, the unreadable images from the January meeting contained data about the design of a new frontline Soviet fighter aircraft scheduled to be operational in the 1990s. So significant was the intelligence that the agency wanted his handlers to initiate an unscheduled meeting in March. The case officer signaled for the meeting, but the reply signal from Tolkachev, opening one of his transom windows between 12:15 p.m. and 2:30 p.m., was not seen. However, one of the other transom windows was open, and later this was thought to have possibly been a danger signal. Without a positive response from Tolkachev, it was decided to wait until June to attempt another meeting. In the first week of June, Tolkachev signaled readiness to meet by opening the middle transom window in his apartment at the indicated time, but the case officer was forced to abort the operation when he detected heavy surveillance. On the next alternate meeting date, June 13th, the readiness to meet signal was again seen at Tolkachev's apartment. This time, the case officer detected no surveillance en route to the meeting, but as he approached the site, more than a dozen KGB personnel wearing camouflaged military uniforms and hiding in nearby bushes jumped him. Bundled into a waiting car, the case officer was taken to the headquarters of the 2nd Chief Directorate at Lubyanka for questioning. During interrogation, the case officer was accused of being a spy and confronted with the package he intended to pass to Tolkachev. Inside were 5 concealed doc copy cameras, books and drawing pens for Tolkachev's son, periodontal medicine, an OTS book concealment containing 250 pages of newspaper and magazine articles requested by Tolkachev, and an envelope with thousands of rubles. An accompanying note thanked Tolkachev for the very important written information he provided at their last meeting, and a description of a new low-light film. The arrest of the case officer was announced to the press, but with no mention of Tolkachev made until September of 1985. Even then, his fate was unknown, and would remain so until October 22, 1986, when the Soviet press announced that Tolkachev had been executed. The compromise of the Tolkachev operation was not triggered by a lapse in tradecraft, but the treason of two CIA officers, first Edward Lee Howard, and later Aldrich Ames. Howard, a disgruntled CIA officer, was dismissed in April of 1983, but had been briefed about Tolkachev in early 1983. Howard likely betrayed the invaluable agent to the KGB in September of 1984 in Austria. Ames confirmed Howard's information when he passed the names of several other CIA assets, including Polyakov, to the KGB in May and June of 1985. In February 1990, the Soviet newspaper Sovetskaya Rossiya described the Tolkachev case in an article that was clearly the work of KGB officials. It contained a number of comments that offered grudging praise for the CIA. CIA provided Tolkachev with a cleverly compiled meeting schedule. CIA instructors made provisions for even the tiniest of details. The miniature camera came with detailed instructions and a light meter. Let us give CIA experts the credit due them. They worked really hard to find poorly illuminated and deserted places in Moscow for meetings with Tolkachev. Anyone unfamiliar with CIA's tricks would never imagine that if a light were to burn behind a certain window in the U.S. Embassy, this could be a coded message for a spy. Langley provided touching care for its agent. If he needed medicine, everything was provided. In every instruction efficiently setting out his assignment, they checked up on his health and went to great pains to stress how much they valued him and how concerned they were for his well-being. The inventory of OTS contributions to the operation involved virtually every element of spy gear and capabilities used by the CIA, including secret writing materials, concealments, one-time pads, multiple models of sub-miniature cameras, light meters, disguises, surveillance detection receivers, commercial cameras, clamps for holding cameras steady, duplicates of security passes, duplicates of library sign-out cards, exfiltration containers, short-range agent communication system, commercial shortwave radio, demodulator unit for radio broadcast, L-pill, the jack-in-the-box, jib, special low-light film. During more than 5 years, case officers and Tolkachev met clandestinely more than 20 times. Never before had this number of personal meetings with an agent inside the Soviet Union been contemplated or securely executed. During the 5 years of Tolkachev's active service, the fusion of tradecraft and technology demonstrated that there were no longer permanently denied areas for agent operations. As early as March of 1979, a memorandum sent to the Director of Central Intelligence outlined the significance of the material beginning to flow from Tolkachev, concluding it to be of incalculable value. From the first rolls of film containing technical data on Soviet aircraft, Tolkachev's reporting was singular in both quality and detail. Especially significant was the window into future Soviet weapon systems that was unobtainable by technical collection programs. Tolkachev provided U.S. military analysts a perspective on Soviet capabilities a decade into the future. That information alone saved the U.S. government billions of dollars in military research and development. Tolkachev's production, in terms of volume and value, was so significant that a special task force exploited it until 1990. A senior CIA operations officer, after an exhaustive study of the case, characterized A.G. Tolkachev a worthy successor to Penkovsky. Chapter 11. An Operation Called C.K. Taw. Secret intelligence has never been for the faint-hearted. Richard Helms, a look over my shoulder. Running concurrently with the Tolkachev operation, a parallel technical collection operation known as CK